and welcome to the Book Podcast, talking with Australian women writers of fiction and non-fiction. I'm Rosemary Putty. Is Where the Dead Go by Sarah Bailey. Sarah Bailey is a Melbourne-based writer with a background in advertising and communications. She has two young children and is currently the managing partner of advertising agency VMLY&R in Melbourne. Over the past 5 years, she has written a number of short stories and opinion pieces. Her first novel, the internationally best-selling The Dark Lake, won the Ned Kelly and Davitt Awards and was published by Allen & Unwin in 2017, followed by Into the Night in 2018. Where the Dead Go is the final book in the award-winning Detective Gemma Woodstock trilogy that began with The Dark Lake and Into the Night. A 15-year-old girl has gone missing after a party in the middle of the night. The following morning, her boyfriend is found brutally murdered in his home. Was the girl responsible for the murder, or is she also a victim of the killer? But who would want two teenagers dead? 4 years after the events of Into the Night, and following a personal tragedy, Detective Gemma Woodstock finds herself in the coastal town of Fairhaven, with her son Ben in tow. She has begged to be part of the murder investigation so she can bury herself in work rather than taking the time to grieve and figure out how to handle the next stage of her life. She now has serious responsibilities she can no longer avoid, but Gemma also has ghosts she must lay to rest. Gemma searches for answers while navigating her son's grief and trying to overcome the hostility of her new colleagues. As the mystery deepens and old tensions and secrets come to light, Gemma is increasingly haunted by a similar missing persons case she worked on not long before. A case that ended in tragedy and made her question her instincts as a cop. Can Gemma trust herself again? Where the Dead Go is Sarah Bailey's third crime thriller, featuring police detective Gemma Woodstock. And I'm very pleased to welcome Sarah back to the podcast today to talk about it. Hello, Sarah.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And yourself?
Yes, I'm good, thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Yes, you're very welcome. Now, Sarah, we talked a couple of years ago when your debut novel, The Dark Lake, was released, and you've taken your character, Gemma, on quite a journey since then. So before we talk about the latest book, which is Where the Dead Go, let's just go back a little bit. Tell us about Gemma's life in that first novel. Where was she living, and what was going on in her life then?
So in The Dark Lake, that was when everyone was introduced to Gemma, and she was about 27, 28 years old, a young mother. She had a partner and she had grown up in that small regional town in New South Wales. She was pretty lost when the book started, and the start of the book was a murder that had happened in the town that she was assigned to as sort of lead detective. And from there, it really all spiraled for Gemma. So a lot of old wounds that had sort of been pasted over were reopened, and all of the current turmoil in her personal life was really amplified by that homicide. And then in the second book, Into the Night, she moved to Melbourne. It was set about 4 years after the first book in The Dark Lake, and a whole sort of different set of circumstances. She was the small fish in a massive pond, which was a flip from her previous role. She had made some pretty drastic decisions in her personal life. And the crime that she was dealing with in that book wasn't personal like it was in the first one. She didn't know the victim, but it sort of had parallels with what was going on in her world. So, yeah, completely different settings and completely different circumstances, but Gemma is consistent in her inconsistency.
That she is. But when at the beginning, when you wrote The Dark Lake, were you expecting it to be a one-off story?
Or did you have an idea that it would go on with this character?
It was definitely written as a one-off story. There was no thought in my mind at the time of writing The Dark Lake, and even really all the way through the editing process, that there would be a second or third book. I guess what happened was, though, that once I did finish The Dark Lake, I certainly started to think about what could happen to that character next. It wasn't sort of formalised in any way, but in my mind I started thinking that it felt slightly unfinished and that potentially there was more to that character and more to explore. And then I was just incredibly fortunate to get an offer to extend the story in the form of a trilogy. So I did have more of a conscious thought around a third book when I was writing the second. It felt as if a series was more likely at that stage, but it certainly wasn't a case of the first one ending on a cliffhanger. It's quite neatly contained as a standalone book, but I think you can sort of certainly see the scope for that character to sort of extend beyond that initial story.
Yeah, I think all three of them, actually, they're all standalone novels. You don't have to have had read any of the others before you get to any one of them. There is a natural arc, obviously, to Gemma's story. Now, you wrote that debut and the publishers obviously wanted you to write another story and Gemma was still with you, but did you ever contemplate a completely new character and scenario for your second book?
I didn't really have time to do that, to be honest, because it happened so quickly that I hadn't really given any thought to what was next until they turned around and said, look, we'd love you to write a second book in the series. So I've certainly now got aspirations to continue and potentially look at new characters and new stories, but between the first and the second book, it was pretty quick. So it was just from one to the other.
Yeah, and of course, at the second book, there was still so much more to explore of Gemma's story. And so Into the Night, the second book, it takes her from her small town, Smithson, to a grittier setting, into Melbourne. So it's a couple of years on. So what has taken Gemma to Melbourne and what challenges did she face once she got there?
So in the first book, she certainly has some issues with her relationship with her partner, the father of her child, and they sort of culminate toward the end of that first book. And then in the second book, she's decided to leave and have a new sort of beginning at the age of kind of 31, 32. So she's in Melbourne in a new workplace. She confronts a whole lot of things that are probably not so much new things, but just things that are amplified. So I guess insecurity around her ability from a professional perspective, really intense loneliness and sort of what she's doing with her life and what her future may or may not be, guilt around her son and the role that she plays in his world. So it's quite a conflicted place for her to be, both geographically away from her friends and family, but also I think mentally just trying to sort of orient herself and work out where she's going to go next.
Well, the story in the second book deals with two crimes. First, she's assigned to the murder of a homeless man, and then a famous actor gets killed on the film set. Now, that's two crimes, two victims, and they couldn't be more different from each other. And it sort of shows that the yin and yang of city life.
Yes, it was sort of it was intentional to have those two really extreme types of victims, but to sort of show that ultimately a homicide is a homicide and, you know, needs to be investigated. However, people do tend to value life slightly differently. It's all down to sort of media attention and even police attention. Having spoken to a lot of police, it certainly is clear that while people individually might have just as much empathy for a victim over another one, there is just an emotional charge to certain cases, and they do tend to get more coverage and more effort, more resource put behind them. It's all very political, obviously. So I think that's quite realistic, but I enjoyed exploring that sort of extreme and that sort of poor versus wealthy, famous versus almost anonymous or, you know, of little value from a societal perspective. And I think Gemma, for all her flaws, is incredibly empathetic and has huge connection with all of her victims. So she found that particularly difficult to navigate and understand, I suppose.
Well, with each book, you move her on a few years. And like life, you know, there have been changes in Gemma's life. So Where the Dead Go, the latest book, sees her now living in Sydney with a new partner. But when the book opens, she's travelled back to her hometown of Smithson. What's brought her back there?
Yeah, so poor Gemma has finally gotten her life on track between book two and book three. But unfortunately, we don't see much of that on the page. It's sort of all happened. And then the third book opens with a tragedy that has brought her back to her hometown, very reluctantly. Mm. Her ex-partner and the father of her child has taken very, very ill. So she's had to return home to look after her son and to sort of work through what their lives are going to be with that information at hand. So she was kind of in a good place, but obviously all dramas need some tension and some upset. So I had to give her a bit of a problem to deal with.
Poor Gemma.
Yeah, well, I know.
She's grief-stricken and traumatised, and she begs to be part of a murder investigation, but not back in Smithson, in the sort of pretty much a far-flung small seaside town of Fairhaven, which is north of Byron. Instead of going back to Sydney, she goes up there. What's happened and why does she want to go?
Yeah, so I think Gemma's natural response to any difficult or disastrous situation is to throw herself into work. It's where she feels the safest and it's where she certainly feels the most useful. So when an opportunity arises to work on a case that's popped up in a more remote coastal area, she jumps at the chance, even though I think it's pretty fair to say it's a slightly questionable decision for her to make based on what's going on in her personal life. But it is her instinct to not so much just run away, but to just throw herself into something that she can focus on. It's a bit of her fight or flight mechanism, I think. So she sort of puts her hand up to work on this case. She's feeling really untethered, having left Sydney and having left that job that she was really enjoying. So she's looking, I think, for some, I guess, personal satisfaction and attention focus from that perspective. So, yeah, she throws herself into this case. There's a 15-year-old girl's gone missing from a party. Her boyfriend has then been murdered the day after. So it's kind of unclear whether or not the girl is missing. Was she potentially the perpetrator? Is she dead also? You know, what's kind of happened? So it's certainly a quite a tangled mystery in that small coastal town.
Yeah, it certainly has. A lot has happened to Gemma in the preceding years. And layered through this story is a case that still haunts her thoughts. Now, it's a really interesting way of showing her emotional and mental state and how it's colouring all the decisions that she makes.
Yeah, I have to thank my publisher for a lot of that sort of story arc, because I think it was her suggestion originally. But it definitely highlighted, I think, that Gemma is coming to this case with a really specific set of emotional precursors. She's had a case that has really haunted her in the past couple of years, one that she does feel a lot of guilt and confusion over. So she's bringing a lot of that baggage to this. And I think that happens a lot with police officers and detectives. Certainly the ones I've spoken to do talk often about a case or cases that have really stuck in their mind, whether or not they feel that they played a role in it not playing out the way they wanted it to, or whether it was just for whatever reason, a circumstance that's really gotten under their skin. But I do feel that, I mean, they're not robots, they're humans like everybody else. And so when they're coming to a case, it is difficult for them to have a completely clean slate. There's always going to be comparisons or references to previous cases, and in Gemma's instance, it's certainly something that's playing on her mind. There's a lot of parallels with that particular incident that happened in Sydney where there was a missing girl, and so I think she's really trying to fight her own head on some sort of aspects of this new case to try to be making sure she's not letting that interfere too much. But of course, it's you know, it's a difficult thing to juggle.
Yeah. Well, each book has two distinct arcs for Gemma. I mean, there's the police procedural one and then there's her personal story. Do you plan them separately so that you know where each of them will end up?
It's a good question, because I think unconsciously I do plan them separately. It sort of tends to be that the actual case part of the story is very much a what if. So all of the books that I've written so far have certainly started with a what if question. So what if a girl that had always lived in a town turned up dead in a lake? She'd happened to be the local high school teacher, and someone she went to school with was assigned to the case as a cop. Go. What would sort of happen from there? The second book, it was very much what if a, you know, famous movie star was murdered on a film set, and even though there was hundreds of witnesses, no one knew who had killed him. Was it an accident? Was it murder? Go. And then I guess with this one, it was very much, if a girl goes missing and her boyfriend turns up dead, is she behind it or is she part of it or is it a coincidence, sort of what happens? So those, the crime part of the books are very much a sort of a what if premise question. And then Gemma's personal arc tends to parallel that in some way. So, I mean, I think in the first book, the parallels were really closely linked, because she was, her relationship with the victim of the homicide was quite complicated. They both came from the same town. They'd literally kind of grown up in parallel. So that was potentially more emotionally resonant and quite easy to keep claustrophobic and close. The second book, it was a bit more difficult because she didn't have a personal tie to the book, to the crime,
yeah.
But she certainly was feeling quite out of her depth, quite overwhelmed. And I think some of those emotions that the crime amplified was, I guess, expressed in her character. And just the city environment really helped that large stage feeling of the whole thing being very, you know, overt media attention. And she felt like under a lot of scrutiny. So I think that sort of helped with that kind of famous celebrity tone that the book enabled. And then in the third one, it was very much a case for me that she'd finally sort of gotten her life on track and then life intervened. And so she was sort of thrown into chaos quite unwillingly. Whereas in the first two books, I think it's fair that, you know, most of the chaos was of her own making to some extent, but she still reacts the way that she does because she's, you know, she's the same person. So there's that trademark Gemma kind of immaturity that does tend to kick in when she's backed into a corner. But she is a good detective, and so it's always a case of trying to make sure the case is running in parallel to what she is experiencing in her own life. And in the third book, she's obviously very lost and very worried about her future and her son's future. So some of the things that the case turns up about parenting and trust and whatever, I think, is kind of then relevant in what she's experiencing herself.
Yeah, absolutely is. There are other characters, obviously, in the book. And one of the characters that I really liked was Constable Edwina De Luca. And through Gemma's observations, we learn just enough to make us curious about her and her life. So with your characters, how deep do you go into their backstory when you're creating them?
I don't go deep in the sense that I write out pages of character references or sort of map through what their lives have been like before the book starts. But I definitely have in my mind a very clear picture of what they look like, what they talk like, how they think, what their relationship to Gemma is. I think that's really important to sort of be clear on so that every time there's dialogue, you know what their thoughts on her are. So with her particularly, I really like Edwina as well. I think she's a really interesting character. And a lot of the reason I think she's interesting is because Gemma is reminded of herself via Edwina in many ways.
Yeah.
And I think it was a good opportunity for Gemma to reflect a bit on how she has grown and how she may have been interpreted as a younger cop and then detective. So it kind of allowed a little bit of self-awareness to creep in, which Gemma sometimes doesn't have enough of. And she was also just a fun sort of feisty character to pair Gemma up with. She's not in the past been paired up with female cops so much, so I kind of liked having that opportunity to do that.
Well, with female police officers and female detectives, in Edwina's case, she's really trying to get that promotion and fighting against that sort of male hierarchy that happens in all sorts of areas and all sorts of careers. So did you talk to many female police officers and did you find that they were restricted in any way?
Yeah, I definitely did. And that goes back to even when I was writing The Dark Lake and mapping out Gemma's character and her feeling within that world. I've spoken to quite a few male and female cops and also a parent of a female cop because I found that quite a good way to get some perspective that they perhaps wouldn't identify themselves. I think it varies. I think there is some really, really great workplaces now. And obviously these days there is also a formal sort of expectation around treatment of all staff and all people, men, women, and sort of, you know, all kinds of diversity beyond that. So I think it's definitely improved, but there is still an old guard, I think, that certainly feels as if perhaps women have been welcomed too much into the police force. And while they can do some roles, should they be doing all roles? So there is still a doubt out there, I think, in the minds of some people who are in really senior roles. I mean, we all know that there is still sexism that goes on in all workplaces and the police force is certainly not exempt from that. And I think in country towns, it's just less likely to have eyeballs on it. So depending on the personality of the person who was in charge in those areas, it can be really varied as to the experience of a younger female in that world. So, you know, in Edwina's case, she's reporting into a manager who's, you know, by all accounts, kind of a nice guy, but she certainly finds the way he treats her to not be entirely appropriate, and she thinks it's impacting her ability to progress. So I think that's certainly realistic based on conversations I've had.
Yeah, you also bring to it, in Gemma's case, the fact that she's not only a really good detective, but she's a mother. So there's conflict there as well. I mean, it's quite a dangerous occupation, or can be quite a dangerous occupation. And as well as you're saying that, you know, females are in some cases not looked upon as should be in certain jobs and certain situations. Being a mother as well brings a whole other sort of scenario into it.
Yeah, it does. And I find this whole topic really interesting and kind of confusing because, you know, I do know that some people will say that once they have children, they operate differently in their world. They would definitely look at doing less risk-taking behaviours. They would think differently about choices that they make. And I understand that to an extent. But I also think that a lot of people, while they might be parents, they don't change fundamentally in any other way. So, yes, you have a responsibility to look after somebody, but do you have a responsibility to act differently in a professional sense or even in a decision sense around activities that you might not do? And I don't know. I think the answer is just different for everybody. And in Gemma's case, she loves being a mother. She loves Ben, and that's not sort of questioned. But she makes what I think a lot of people would deem to be very poor decisions in terms of her personal safety, which ultimately could have an impact on Ben and his mental health and well-being. So it's confusing and complicated, I think. And I think a lot of judgment around parenting in general is actually boils down to that sort of issue. What responsibility do you have to look after yourself because you have a child?
Yeah.
And it's subjective, I think.
Mm. With all of the police procedural work that you have to write into the story, who helps you with that? Have you got one particular person you go to, or is it a range of people that you talk to?
Yeah, I tend to do very little research first. I really like to get the story that I would like to tell organised in my mind and mapped out from a plot perspective by basically writing a first draft. And then I tend to go back and fact check my own story. So I will write a draft with sort of complete freedom to make sure that I guess it's the best story it can be. Then I tend to do desk research. So I'll go through and check DNA wait times or particular medical things that I've detailed in the book or procedural processes in New South Wales Court of Law or whatever that might be. And that's all pretty easy to ascertain sort of online. And then ultimately I'll get sort of to a point where I'm a bit stuck on a couple of things that are sort of quite grey areas. But what I tend to do then is I've got a couple of people that I can go to and ask questions of. And my questions are always really specific because I don't want them to read the book and give me a point of view on the whole story and how they would navigate each and every particular proof point in the book.
Yeah.
I more just want to say, is this possible, yes or no? Because I find that if you kind of ask for someone's opinion, you'll get really subjective feedback from them on exactly how they would approach something.
Yes.
Whereas I'm in the world of fiction, I just need to know, can this happen, yes or no? Is this feasible? Is this possible? So it's a little bit more specific intentionally. I want to keep true to the story that I think is the strongest for someone to read and just make sure the facts can fit in with my story as opposed to sort of getting all the facts down and then trying to write a story that ticks every box, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Where the Dead Go, though, it ends on a hopeful note, but is this the end of Gemma Woodstock's life in print or is it just a pause?
Well, I don't know, because in my mind it is the end at the moment, and that's, you know, there is no plans for a fourth book at this stage. So I didn't intentionally end it on a cliffhanger of any kind, although I have had a couple of people say to me since reading it that they want to know what happens next.
You're going to disappoint a lot of people out there if Gemma doesn't carry on.
I know. I mean, I think that the crime is certainly resolved in the third book, which I always think is really important for any kind of crime fiction book. You need to give people the answers to the mystery. But Gemma's personal circumstances, I suppose, are still a little bit up in the air. So I can understand why people are sort of saying, well, it would be good to know what happens to her next. And I'm certainly open to potentially continuing her story. I guess I would just need to feel compelled to have something to say. I think she could be a great character in someone else's story, maybe a peripheral kind of character, so that people can see what's happened to her and what she's doing without her necessarily being the engine of the new book. So, you know, maybe that could happen one day. I kind of know what I think happens to her. But, yeah, I might just need to sort of think through where and how she would most appropriately return to the page.
Yeah, well, there's no tidy ends in life either, is there? There's always things that go on. But let's leave Gemma for a moment and talk about life outside your writing. You manage a creative projects agency. So what is your day-to-day life like?
Pretty hectic. So, I work in advertising in an agency in Melbourne. There's a big team of people that I manage. And it's great. I really enjoy it. I actually don't do a creative role in the agency. I'm more in the sort of business management, finance, HR role, I suppose. So I think that really helps give me a break from that intensity of writing. It's busy and hectic, but in more of a choppy way. So there's lots of different things to do. There's lots of meetings. There's lots of challenges. There's lots of things to organise. But it's not that sitting down for sort of 8-hour blocks and just writing. So I really enjoy it. And I think that, I don't know, I feel like over the last few years, I've realised that I'm just the kind of person that likes to be busy. My writing doesn't seem to be affected by whether I'm working full time or part time or whatever. It sort of just happens in the background. But I tend to look forward to the writing more when it's different from what I'm doing sort of during the day, every day. So it's fun at the moment, and I'm really enjoying it.
Well, hopefully no one is perpetrating a crime in your office, but does your career ever spark ideas for your books?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's not so much even that, obviously I work in an advertising agency and there's not a lot of crime going on in the office as far as I can tell. There's a lot of young, dynamic, interesting people though, and I think that's just often what triggers ideas. And I think it's funny, like even if you're writing, whether it's horror or romance or crime or literary fiction, I think being around people and seeing new things and listening to different conversations, even when they're not directly relevant in any way to something that you're thinking about writing or that you're writing, I do think that you just pick up on mannerisms or personality traits or the way someone reacts to a situation. It can all inspire your, sort of something in your own writing. And a lot of the work that I write in terms of crime, it's very much people-based, it's psychology-based, not always just around the crime itself, but just, you know, the characters in the book and the way that they operate. So I don't ever base the character on someone I know, but you certainly can kind of cherry-pick little traits and moments and things that they wear or things that they've said. And it does, I think, all just generate and fuel that interest in people and that character creation. So, yeah, I find my brain is subconsciously reviewing things and adding to a little list somewhere up there that ends up on the page at some point.
Well, you know, there's a cliche that says life is stranger than fiction. Do you ever read a newspaper article or hear a story and think, I'd never get away with that for my characters? Or conversely think, yes, I'll tuck that away for later?
Oh, definitely. I think the news is sort of a huge inspiration for me for plot points and twists, and not directly lifting them and shifting them into my book, but more that you'll read a story and just think, wow, that's quite convoluted, but it does give you some inspiration as to how you might be able to plot, you know, either a subplot or something in your own story. But absolutely, there is times where you would read a newspaper article and just think, I don't think my editors would buy this if I had presented it in my story. I know a lot of people, you know, even sort of said that about the US election when Trump was appointed. There was a couple of people that had written dystopian fiction that was similar and it had been rejected a few years earlier. So it definitely does seem as if sometimes the news is transcending all craziness, even when it comes to fiction. So, yeah, it's an interesting time that we're living in, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you just mentioned it a little while ago. With a career and family, taking time for yourself and your writing, you know, that's often difficult to fit in. So where do you fit in your writing time?
Well, it does very much depend on where I am at in the process of writing, because for me it's really sort of quite distinct phases. It's thinking and not a lot happens, but I guess my brain is busy sort of just churning around ideas and characters and orders of events. And then there's the writing part, which is just trying to download all of that mess into some sort of format, into words on a page. And then once there's a full draft down, it's that horrible, tedious editing process that I do find quite difficult. So I quite like writing pretty sort of hard and fast, that first draft. I think because it's crime fiction that I'm writing and it is sort of pacey, it suits that manic download feeling. And I find that the short, sharp bursts of writing for me are actually quite effective because I can really get that energy sort of coming to life in the page as well. And then when I'm editing, it's wrangling. It just feels like such a tricky phase to work through, and I tend to like to have more time to run at it and keep all of the thoughts in my head at one time. I find editing harder to dip in and out of. It's a bit more difficult to hold the whole sort of book in my head at any given time and you know, join the dots together and understand if I delete something from here, I need to update this over here. So the actual sort of writing of the draft, I can do in really crazy bits and pieces, half an hour here, an hour there. I can do it wherever. It doesn't seem to require as much kind of concentration, I suppose. Mm. But then once I'm in the editing phase, I really need quite big chunks of time to get my head straight, to think sort of clearly and properly, to read sections out aloud, and that kind of more measured process, I guess. So, yeah, it does depend a bit on where I'm at in the journey.
Yeah, I just love crime writers. You've written three crime books now, and I mean, if you're going around the supermarket, I'd be thinking, do I need milk? You're thinking, how can I murder this person?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I still find it completely amazing that I've written three books and that they happen to be crime. Like, the whole thing feels like a bit of a blur. And if someone said, we've lost the files of your books and you need to rewrite them, I know I couldn't do it. So it's sort of, it did feel like a bit of a moment in time. And I love writing, and I always have loved writing, love reading as well. But it sort of, even for me, just feels quite strange. I don't feel like a crime writer person. I don't sort of think I have got particularly dark thoughts compared to other people. But I am really interested in what makes people tick and the psychology of people. And I think that ultimately crime is sort of all about that. And I know it's got a darker lens across it, but it is still really about, why do people act the way they do? What drives someone to sort of really react in a horribly cold-blooded way, that emotional response. So I think it's more psychology, I suppose, as opposed to sort of outright crime that I'm drawn to. Yeah, I'm definitely surprised anybody to have written three crime novels, because I certainly don't feel that that's an area that I'm particularly drawn to more than anyone else. I mean, I think crime in general is really popular. I know true crime is incredibly popular in the world of books and podcasts. And I think people are just fascinated by what makes other people tick and what pushes people over the edge. And, you know, could that be me is always the question. And what would I do in that circumstance? And, yeah, I think everyone finds that interesting. And I love that with crime you get that real extreme of human emotions. The stakes are really high. So it's kind of people amplified. And that's certainly what I'm interested in.
With writing your next book, when your next book comes along, you say that you don't consider yourself a crime writer, more psychological. Would it be more, are you looking at writing another crime book, or would it be more like a psychological thriller?
I don't know. I guess the Gemma Woodstock series was really clearly dictated as crime because she's a detective and a homicide detective. So it's sort of straight away you're in that world and it can't not be crime. But I am, like I say, drawn to those sort of darker stories and those what-if premises. So my current thinking is I'm looking at having a journalist as a main character in the next book, working on a cold case. So it's certainly still in the world of crime, but I'm having to work out how to best find the clues, because cops and detectives have such great access to information, and journalists have the means, and they certainly have the intent, but they don't always have the same level of access. So trying to kind of just work through how to keep the story driven along without that heartbeat of the law is interesting. But yeah, it'll definitely be the world of crime and definitely still a mystery to be solved.
A little bit like Simon in this book.
Yes, but not, yes, a bit different from Simon, but yes, definitely that, definitely Simon's world.
Simon's world.
I love the whole journalist career. I just think it's such an interesting job to have, and I think there's lots of challenges to journalism these days with the sort of change of landscape and how people are consuming content, but that's kind of potentially all part of the story as well. Yeah, it's another female journalist character. Different, very different from Gemma, but still feisty in her own way.
That investigative journalist scene is really, really interesting too, the things that they can uncover by just digging and digging and digging.
Yeah, I do think that there's a bit of a renaissance with journalism, despite all of the challenges that they face. But some of those exposés over the recent years from, the Washington Post and the sort of the Catholic Church, all the way through to sort of cold cases that they've really lifted the lid on and gotten all the way back into court again, sort of feels like there's a bit of a turning of the tide in the value that they offer the community. And so, yeah, I'm kind of keen to explore that and bring that to life.
With all things going on in your life, do you get time to read? And if so, what have you read? What have you read maybe this year that you really enjoyed?
No, I do. I definitely do read. I'm probably reading a little bit less right now because I'm just, very busy couple of months. Earlier this year, I deliberately set aside a lot of time to read, and I've read Sally Hepworth's The Mother-in-Law, which loved.
Yeah.
I thought it was a really good sort of balance between like crime and domestic sort of thriller. I read Peggy Frew's Islands, and I thought that was awesome. I really enjoyed that. It was a beautiful book. I'm just reading Ben Hobson's Snake Island at the moment because I'm interviewing him for an event shortly.
Oh, okay.
And that's really great too. And I read Rob McDonald's The Nancys, which was a really cool sort of twist on a crime thriller. It was very, very humorous, amazing characters. So I recommend checking that one out. But yeah, I do. I definitely do read quite a lot still, and I am always reading something. It just depends the pace of how I get through it is dependent on what else is going on, I guess.
Yeah. Well, Where the Dead Go is a suspenseful, riveting thriller. While Gemma is searching for answers, she's navigating her son's grief and overcoming the hostility of her new colleagues. It's a compelling read with multi-layered plots and great characters. I highly, highly recommend it. Sarah, I want to thank you so much for coming back and talking to me today, and I wish you every success with Where the Dead Go.
Oh, thank you so much for talking to me and for having me. And if people read the book, I hope they really enjoy it.
I'm sure they will. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Rosemary.
And that was Sarah Bailey talking about her book, Where the Dead Go. Where the Dead Go is published by Allen & Unwin. And the music on today's podcast is Going Home by Lee Rosevere. Next, we're talking to Wendy James, the author of The Accusation, which is a powerful exploration of the fragility of trust and the lure of the mob, from the Ned Kelly Award-winning author of The Golden Child and The Mistake. After 18-year-old Ellie Canning is found shivering and barely conscious on a country road, her bizarre story of kidnap and escape enthralls the nation. Who would do such a thing, and why? Local drama teacher Susanna Wells, once a minor celebrity, is new to town. Suddenly she's in the spotlight again, accused of being the monster who drugged and bound a teenager in her basement. As stories about her past emerge, even those closest to her begin to doubt her innocence. And Ellie? The media can't get enough of her. She's a girl power icon, a social media star. But is Ellie telling the truth? And that's next week on the podcast. I hope you can join me.
You've been listening to The Book Podcast. Details of this program can be found on our website, thebookpodcast.com. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. It's free. And please, while you're there, leave a review. It'd really help. You can follow us via Facebook and Twitter at The Book Podcast. I'm Rosemary Puddy. I hope you've enjoyed the program. Thank you for listening.